supposed to be a long weekend for me. No, back at school, someone like Dane probably wouldn't call me Mr. Simmons. He'd be like, "Hey, Simmons." No, he wouldn't do that. We're going to be starting in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Be taking, trying to get through a bulk of the chapter here on this today. So just to review the things that Jack's been emphasizing, what's our theme verse? What's our theme from chapter 1? Chapter 1, verse 14. Someone to read that. I hear the pages turning.
Dave? I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind.
Okay, and we're talking about life under the sun for the vast majority of this. And as Jack has mentioned, some people like to go here and like to point out things that are not correct and twist things around, that, you know, God not in your life and that sort of thing. But that's not the case. We're going to see that here in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Because we're going to see there's this little interlude here at the beginning of chapter 5, because he'd been doing life under the sun. And the grievousness and the futility of it, along with some wisdom and some advice of how to live life on this earth under the sun and make the best of it. At the end of chapter 4, he's talking about the better was the poor and wise youth than the old and foolish king, so it's better to be wise than foolish in some of these things. But verses 15 and 16 says, I saw all the living at the end of chapter 4. I saw all the living who move about under the sun along with that youth who is a stand in the king's place. And there was no end of all the people of whom he led. Yet those who will come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and striving after the wind. So we're continuing, just even if you're better, live life under the sun in a better way with wisdom and good choices, it's still vanity and striving after the wind. And so in chapter 5, and we're going to take a look at the first few verses here to begin with, he steps out from life under the sun. And as the chapter 5, verse 1, he starts saying, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Okay, so life under the sun he's starting to bring back, okay, you're... guard your steps when you go to the house of God. This sort of this interlude, we're back to trying to come to God and to worship him. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near, to listen, is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. Guard your steps. What's that mean? What? Guarding your steps.
It's having control.
Control?
Living with a purpose.
A purpose?
Being careful how you walk.
Being careful. This, the original meaning there is that of really keeping, protecting, you know, watching very carefully, like you're protecting a treasure or something. And so what is this guarding the steps? What's the meaning here? And we get that in the second part of the verse. Who draw near to listen is better to offer the sacrifice of fools. And when you're approaching God, be careful. Be very careful. And Solomon's saying, okay, we need to make sure we treat God as God and who he is. In Isaiah there, as we have chapter 1, verses 13 and 7 through 17, if I could get a someone to read that for me. Get a volunteer to read.
Therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place. In the wrath of
Isaiah 1, chapter 1.
Bring no more futile sacrifices. Increases in incense is an abomination to me. The new moon, the Sabbath, and the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity in the sacred meeting. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They are a trouble to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Rebuke the oppressor. Defend the fatherless. Plead for the widow.
So here Isaiah is chastising children of Israel after the time of Solomon. So obviously they did not, the generation Solomon did not heed this. What's Isaiah saying to the people of Israel about how do we guard our steps? Keep his commandments, but keeping them in the right way, isn't it? Was there another people? Did the children of Israel learn this lesson at all?
They heard it, and they said that they would do it, but they continually fell away from it.
We come to the New Testament times, and what's one of the main points Jesus made to the Pharisees when he talked to them? Yeah, they were not, what, guarding their steps. They were not listening and treating him as holy. In Leviticus, in the giving of the law, chapter 18, God speaking to Moses about the various laws and so forth. And he says, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt, where you lived. You shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan, which I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord. It's watch how you walk. Don't do what they do. Don't what they do. Do what I tell you to do. And so Solomon here saying, watch your steps as we approach the house of God. I think we see this in our culture today that we don't. Do people treat God as holy today in our culture? No, it's where God's supposed to accept them and what they do as instead of the other way around. It brought to mind, as I thought about this, the movie Fiddler on the Roof. The musical, and there was a song that he sings at one point, that if I were a rich man, right, the main character, and not everything from the song is good, you know, if you're a rich man, he's strutting around all the things he would talk about and do, but one of the things at the end actually hit home with this idea of drawing near to listen is better than to offer sacrifice to fools. And part of that song, he goes, if he was a rich man, he would, what, go to the church. And he would, he says, and I'd discuss the learned books with the holy men 7 hours every day, and that would be the sweetest thing of all. Compared to all the other things he talked about in the sun, the sweetest thing of all would be able to, what, spend time in God's word. And Solomon's going, don't come, what? Well, instead of me telling you, what's that really mean? To listen, to draw near to listen is better. What does that mean to draw near to listen in your minds?
Well, you think of Mary and her situation and Martha.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus made it very clear, Mary has chosen the right thing, to listen, to hear, to draw near to God's word.
Mary and Martha, when Martha was so busy about the house, yes. To draw near to listen. Does that mean we come and when we come to worship, we draw near to God? Does that mean we don't engage with one another and speak? No. What does that mean to listen?
We draw near to worship. Let's make sure we're coming to worship God's parents, that our life reflects the worship that we're giving.
Okay, so it seems to, if I can sum up, we need to come with the right heart. And not just on a Sunday. Ryan.
Well, when you draw near to listen, you're listening with the intent of hearing the Holy Word and how it would apply in your life. If you need to make changes, then you need to make changes. And that's, you know, hopefully your heart is open to that. Like the Bereans, we should study the Scriptures and see if we need to make change.
Wayne, Joanne? Mm-hmm. To draw near to listen, does that mean just to hear and then forget?
No.
No. We'll skip to the second one first. James 1, we all know that passage fairly well. Most of us, what does he say there? Do not become a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the word. And if we do that, if I can turn my pages here, what does he say is going to happen? We'll be blessed in what we do. For he who looks at himself and goes away and once forgets what he was like, but the one who looks into the perfect law, so here looking and listening is the same concept. One who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. I tell you that. David can tell you lots of stories about things I've heard and that I've forgotten. Right? And I always get myself in trouble that way. I'll get that. And did I really hear? No, I need to work better on that. So Solomon's saying, when we come, we got better to listen. Come, and I'm put up there Micah 6:8, one of my favorite verses, in which Micah writes what? What does he require of you, O man, but to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God? What does walking humbly entail? If I'm walking humbly following somebody, what am I doing? Submitting, and am I listening? Yeah, I'm there listening and following and step by step and trying to do and...
All through Joshua and previous to that, God kept telling, through Joshua and reminding the people, saying what God has done for them as a constant reminder, and telling them, then this is what will happen. And so there's always a blessing in the curse. And it's the same thing here in Ecclesiastes. If you listen intently and obey and follow, then I will bless you. I will take care of you. I will guard your life. I'll take care of things for you. But the minute you resource upon your own will is when everything goes awry. And that's what God is saying.
And going back to the Pharisees in the first century there with Jesus, what did he say to them over and over and over again? Woe unto you. as you're making the traditions of men as a commandment. Say they were doing their own will, as you just mentioned, instead of actually listening to what was there, trying to make it fit their own category. So we need to listen better than offer as a fool. And he continues this idea, and he sort of continues this idea of speaking and expounds on it. What does this mean to be better to listen? The next couple of verses of Ecclesiastes 5 is he expounds upon this, and he says what? In verse 2, be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few, for a dream comes with much business or busyness, and a fool's voice with many words. So how does this shed more light on this idea of it's better to listen? Because he's sort of expounding that idea of it's better to listen than to be a fool. So it says, be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. Now, I have a few places up here, back in James. We know that one pretty well. Let's just get to there real quick again. Prior to the idea of the mirror, he says in verse 19 and 25, he says what? Notice, brethren, let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. And then he expounds on that, as we did already. What's being quick to hear mean? We look at it, and we do. Hearing is, listening is what? Actually taking in and responding to. So let not your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. What does that mean?
Brad, one of the best examples that comes to mind is, you mentioned a movie. I don't remember who the actor was. I just remember the scene where it was a lighthearted movie, and this poor fella was in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I will, and at that point, when you open your mouth, you make a vow of what you will do in return. And then you come back later and say, well, you know, I made a mistake. I didn't mean that I gave up that much. At that time, I think God is saying, you know, I'm up here in heaven and you're on earth, and you're speaking like a fool. That's the way I see it in the simple terms.
When Jesus was speaking to the
you gotta be careful.
This was not people in the world. This
yeah,
was
the religious.
The religious mm-hmm. leaders. And I think that's for us, how are we conducting ourselves and our
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When the children of Israel often rebelled against Moses and what Moses was telling them, Moses wasn't hasty to pronounce judgment upon them. He went and conferred with the Lord, and he talked to him, and then came back with the words from God. I think the hasty is uttering a word before God without giving it much consideration and thought about what you're saying. And likewise, Moses was really good about that, in that he would always console before the Lord before he went back and pronounced any kind of judgment or anything against them. It was after he talked to the Lord about it.
Mm-hmm. Not being rash, not being quick to respond. And in James, he says, don't be what? Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to wrath. It's when we get irritated, we get angry, is that when we tend to just pop off and say things that we probably shouldn't? But he's more here, he's getting more to utter a word before God. When we say we're going to do something, is everything we say, as was pointed out, is everything we say before God? When we say we're going to do something, should we do it?
By your words you'll be justified, by your words you'll be condemned.
What did they say in the New Testament? Let your yes be. Don't swear on all these different things, like the Pharisees wanted to swear on the temple or the gold in the temple, or, right? These, don't swear on these things. Let your yes be yes and no be no. And so as we bring God back in the picture, Solomon's going, okay, let's get things in the right perspective here. If we're going to promise to do something for God, then make sure you do those things. And do them, and we'll see, do them quickly. And what's the context area? For God's in heaven, you're on earth. So we got to remember that where we're at. How did Job respond to God when God finally came to him and spoke to him, as we have recorded at the end of Job? God manifested himself in the whirlwind. How did Job respond when God finally spoke to him?
His response was basically, I opened my mouth once.
Because what got Job in trouble? Job had done pretty good, but he started getting in trouble, said, I'll argue my case before God. And he started getting a little rash with his words. And when God answered him, what did Job all of a sudden realize? I should not have opened my mouth. I forgot my place. When we see horrible things happen, should we be, as many think, there's the shooting in Florida and different horrible things happen in this life. Should we be rash? Why, God, why do you let... wait a minute. Who are we to question why God lets something happen or doesn't let something happen? We should not be rash with our words. In the Psalms 34, verses 11 through 14, he talks about this a little bit. This is David. And he writes, come, O children, listen to me, and I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may say good? Okay. Who out there doesn't want to see good days and have a long life, right? Everybody wants that. Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. We want to have good things. Let's not be rash with what we speak before God. And he continues on in what was some of the problems they were having. He says, therefore, let your words be few. And what's the connection that Solomon's making here in this case to the life under the sun? For a dream comes with much busyness. Or business, you could probably interpret it either way. And a fool's voice with many words. First of all, a fool is one that's just always talking, and they, we've seen those kind of people, right? They just jabber away, acting like they know everything, and you can, you know that they really know nothing. But a dream comes with much busyness. Is that true? If you have a dream to fulfill, a dream of something under the sun, maybe it's a dream garden. Does that come with much busyness? I hear kids all the time at school going, you know what, I want to, when I graduate, I'm going to open my own business and, you know, be a contractor and do all this and blah, blah, blah. Going, okay, that's good. Do you understand what comes with that? What are they doing? They're opening their mouths and they're just spewing forth without understanding. To use an example, we have some of our different classes, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior classes. They want to do good things by doing some community service, which is wonderful, right? Do things to clean up the school or provide and do some community service and provide some good examples. And some of them got real ambitious and said, hey, we want to go paint these wooden bleachers where the paint's peeling or, you know, flaking off and they're starting to look ugly. Great, let's go do that. Being I've spent some time in the paint business, I went to him after I heard about this. I'm going, do you understand what's all involved? How to do that properly? How to prepare the surface? The sanding and the prepping and the priming and all the work that goes into that? And it just wasn't there. What a dream comes with, but let's be careful what we promise to do. What does the scripture say in the New Testament about saying what you're going to do in the future?
God will.
Don't say, yeah, tomorrow, today I'm going to do this, and tomorrow I'm going to do that, and tomorrow, and make these plans without what? God in mind. Rather say, if the Lord wills. Dream comes with much busyness, and a fool's what? What's he saying? It's foolish to do what? Is it wrong to have dreams? No, what's the connection here? The connection is, if you do the dreams without God, it's foolish. You're not gonna, it's not gonna be there. And so here in verse 4, it gets a little more detailed. Keep in mind, all this is what? Under guarding our steps. And when you vow a vow to God, do not delay in paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It's better that you should not vow than you should vow and not pay. Promise to do something, we got to do it. I've been guilty of that. And I have to apologize every time I do it. And I've got to be careful about not promising things to do that I can't do. Now, this word vow, we're getting a little more serious here. What's a vow? It's a serious promise, isn't it? And so it's pay what you, if you vow it. What's one of the famous Old Testament things about someone who kept their vow? They made a rash vow and then they ended up having to keep it to their detriment.
The man's daughter.
Yeah.
I can't remember where it's at, but he had vowed something would happen. He would sacrifice the first thing that came into his house unto his daughter.
Yeah. I've gone blank on it now myself. It wasn't Dinah, was it? No, it wasn't. But he made the vow and said, you know, if this happens, then the next thing I see, I'm going to sacrifice to God. And what was the next thing he saw?
His daughter.
His daughter. And he kept the vow. So let's not be hasty with our words. So verse 6. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity. But God is the one you must fear. Why is there so much emphasis on what we say?
Because a lot of hurt and distrust can happen. We vow that we're going to serve God. If we don't keep it, God is displeased. It'd be no different if you were moving and I said to you, I'm going to come over and help you with your move. I'll be there at 8 o'clock. And you say, great. And then you have five or six others that say they're going to be there at 8 to help you move, Brad. And nobody shows up. They don't call you. They don't say anything. And nobody's there on the day of your move. How does that make you feel, number one?
Mm-hmm.
Number two, where is the ownership of those who made that promise to you to help you move? Are they relieved of that burden? No, they're not. And God sees all of it. And he knows when you've said that you're going to do something and you don't keep it, he's going to hold you accountable to it.
Brad, that was Jephthah and Judges 11.
Oh, Jephthah. Okay, yeah.
Daughter.
Thank you, Jephthah.
Judges chapter 11.
Thank you. If we can control what we say, our tongue, will most of the rest of our life be able to be handled? That's what James 3 talks about. I'm not going to read the chapter, but what the entire chapter is what? Talking about taming the tongue. Gives there is what, you know, a rudder stirs an entire ship. How small a flame starts a forest fire. And it says, for every kind of, verse 7 of chapter 3, it says, every kind of beast and bird and reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no human being can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil and full of deadly poison. And he talks about blessings and curses. Can we one moment, and I'm not talking about people of the world, I'm talking about us in here, because I've been guilty of it. Can we one moment be saying good things and blessing one thing, and the next, that guy cuts us off, and I've been guilty of this past, I've got to work on it. That guy cuts us off, and just be, maybe not actually say words, but you're just grumbling and, right? Blessings and curses. It shouldn't be that. He says it shouldn't not be that way. So if we can control the tongue, we really are guarding our steps. And in James chapter 5, verse 12, he comes back to that. He says, towards the end of the letter, right? Under this letter, he's talked about faith and works and the tongue and everything. In chapter 5, verse 12, he says, but above all, my brothers, do not swear, and this is the yes, yes piece, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes, your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. It is such a hard thing to discover, to control. It's something we all have to watch daily. And the moment we forget to watch it, that's when we slip up. Moving on, that's his little interlude of getting back to God, but then he continues on with some things under the sun. He goes back to life under the sun in verse 8. And he talks about oppression. We can look at different things of oppression. Now, we had Holocaust survivors. They were definitely, I'm taking extreme examples of oppression. Japanese prisoners of wars made to go on those death marches. I had the privilege at a veterans assembly to meet people who'd survived some of these things. Civil rights, especially back in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, there was oppression. And it's wrong. But what does Solomon say? If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, when you see oppression, what does it say? Don't be amazed. Don't be surprised. As we saw before, there's what? Nothing new under the sun. It's going to happen. Is it right? No. Is it horrible? In many cases, yes. Right? Oppression can take many levels. don't be surprised. We see some of that oppression even with speaking of trying to support your whatever faith it is you have. Even in our culture today, should we be surprised that there are those in the media that lash out and say evil things about people who express their faith? Shouldn't be surprised. Do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. And of course, what was the lesson that God taught Nebuchadnezzar, as recorded in Daniel? What did he make Nebuchadnezzar become for, what was it, 7 years? Like a beast in the field, eating grass? Until Nebuchadnezzar realized what? God rules over all these things. And when we see these oppressions, don't be amazed, but what can we know? God will give justice for it. It will come, just not in the way we maybe think it would. And this is a curious verse, and actually this one puzzled me for a while, and I can give my interpretation, but if you got something, a different view on it, he follows this idea of don't be amazed at the oppression by the rulers with, but this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. I struggled with this a little bit because I'm going, oppression leads to cultivated fields? That doesn't, to me, make sense. So the best I can understand this, and if someone has some insight into this, I would be glad to hear. When he says but, he's giving an opposite view. When you have severe oppression, is that going to lead necessarily to gain for the whole land and cultivated fields? No. What's the opposite of that? A ruler who what? What is gain for a land? A king committed to cultivated fields. Someone who's committed to helping the people that he rules over prosper. Right? Wayne?
Brad, I'm going to take a different take.
Okay, thank you.
A different take, I think, is that the king, even the king, reaps the harvest for himself. He's milking the land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it is.
Okay. Because it's to his benefit to have cultivated fields.
Yeah.
Okay. So another way of, even though the oppression is going to be going on, the person up ultimately in charge physically wants cultivated fields, and those help everybody. So I don't know. It could go either way. If anyone else has insight into that, I'd be glad. Glad to hear it. This one puzzled me. Getting close on time. The remainder of as we go to the rest of this, it starts with the chapter in verse 10 through verse 17. It talks about loving money. And just going to go through this briefly. We've only got about 4 or 5 minutes here. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth his income. This also is vanity. We saw that in parables of Jesus, talked about the rich young man who, you know, had all his barns. He says, I'm going to build new barns and big barns and sit back and enjoy my eat. Right? They're never satisfied. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. What advantage is their owner but to see them with his own eyes? So what's the benefit of having wealth? Being able to sit back and look at it. That's about it. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. So the person rich is so worried about his wealth and whatever, he has trouble sleeping. But someone who, what, goes out and works, does a good hard day's work, they sleep pretty well at night, don't they? 1 Timothy, going back there, 1 Timothy 6 talks about desire to be rich falls into, those who desire to be rich fall into many temptations. And the often misquoted verse, the love of money is not the root of all evil, but the not money is the root of all evil, but the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. That's basically what he's getting at there. There's a grievous evil I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture, and he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. And I thought of some of the, you know, the way the stock market recently has. One day you can have a lot, the next day if you have the wrong investments, what? You have nothing. Big stores such as recently Kmart and Sears, stores closing all over the country. People who had jobs one day and all of a sudden the next, nothing, or those investors losing their money. And he came from his mother's womb, and he shall go again. Naked he came, and then shall take nothing for his toil, but that he may carry away in his hands. What does that remind, who does that remind us of in the Old Testament? Job. Well, he said, naked I came to this world, and I'm paraphrasing, naked I'm going to go. The Lord blesses, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Talking about, you can't take it with you. And that's sort of what the last few verses, that's sort of what talks about. This is also a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. What gain is there to him and toils in the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. If you pursue wealth, you do all this, you may gain some, such as the pharaohs and these other people who gain all this wealth. And in the end, what is it all really given to you? Vexation, sickness, and anger.
And we have many cases in God's word where there were very wealthy people, and they used their wealth in his service. And so to him who has, more will be given. And the fact is, there's many who have good wealth that use it in the Lord's service, and that's to be commended.
Mm-hmm.
Children of Israel were encouraged to give to them, to help them and take care of their brother,
mm-hmm.
and to see that they were cared for. And that was God's will.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a person who reaches wealth or has wealth and uses it in his service, that's to be highly commended.
Exactly. In the Paul's letters, instruct those who are rich to be rich in good works.
Yeah.
But here we're talking about life under the sun. He's going back to just life under the sun, and you're just pursuing wealth for wealth's sake. You can't, I mean, what is it, King Tut? You know, all the gold and the treasures, the Egyptian process of bearing all these treasures with them to take them into the afterlife, but obviously with understanding, it doesn't go with you. And who ended up with much of those treasures?
Robbers.
Thieves and robbers. Or how about Roy, I don't see Roy and Nell here this morning, but they were able to go to China and see the terracotta, these emperors of China who created all these statues and built these magnificent creations for their tombs. They don't take it with them. And so this is that other grievous evil he's seeing under the sun. It's why work that hard just for wealth's sake? It doesn't do anything but bring you vexation and grief.
Brad,
and I got to wrap up here. So.
Okay. Some people say that's the most misquoted thought or verse in the Bible. Is that true? About money being the root of all?
I don't know if it's the most misquoted one, but
it is
often misquoted.
Yeah.
And so next week we'll pick up there in chapter 5, verse 18. As we're going to see, okay, you do all this, what is the benefit under the sun that you get from your labors? What's the one thing you can get from it? Take a look at that. Thank you.